What a nurse practitioner is, for those of you who don't know, is I was trained as a registered nurse and then went on to further training to specialize, in my case, in obstetrics and gynecology. And I'm licensed by the state to do well women care. So I see women who come to see me for their annual exams, for birth control questions, for sexually transmitted disease problems, older women who see me for menopause issues, and then women who just come in for their every year pap and pelvic exam. And what I kind of want to do tonight is go over like some basic anatomy and physiology, anatomy just being sort of the structure that's there, and the physiology being how that structure works in sort of the normal menstrual cycle, because I think that you kind of need as a baseline, and then we can ask other questions, because that relates to things like birth control, it relates to things like menopause, and it relates to things like PMS. So if, you know, if any of those are your burning issues here today, or if you were sent here to find out about those things, I can explain those better if I've already set up that other thing. My husband, Winston, is going to come as well. He's a physician, and if people have specifically male anatomy and physiology-oriented questions, he can answer those better than I can, because I really do specialize in women, and so I can give you an idea about women, but I can't tell you much about how you all work, so he can do a better job with that. You can close the door if you want, Jeff. Let me see which I should start with here. I'm going to pass around, I don't have slides, but what I have is a lot of handouts. And the first thing I'm going to pass around is just sort of your basic female anatomy. And I can't draw all of it up here. I drew sort of the basic stuff. And you can look at this and see what at least people who make medical textbooks think women look like. So whether or not that's what they look like, that's up to you to decide. But and this is the basic structures that I'm going to be talking about tonight. The uterus, and this is where the baby grows. Now, I don't know how much people know and how little people know, so I may be a little bit too simplistic, and if I am, say, hey, you know, we know that, but on the other hand, I don't want to lose anybody in this discussion. And I have absolutely no idea, frankly, you know, where or how you've gotten your information over the years, so I'll start out being relatively basic. You're a man. You can come in. Yeah. This is my husband, Winston, and so he'll be doing some of the other stuff.
I'm going to keep her straight.
I'll try.
This is the uterus, and as I said, this is where a baby would grow. A uterus in actual size, this is not drawn to size, obviously. A uterus is about the size of a little light bulb or a small pear, and it sits right about down here. And then what we have coming off from that are what are called the fallopian tubes, and they connect to the ovary, and you can see they don't actually connect. There's not... The ovary, when it makes an egg, this is where the eggs come from, gets released and then flows down these tubes down into the uterus. And then this is the vagina. The opening of the uterus is called the cervix. And when you've heard about women going into labor and their cervix, when they say, are they to 10 yet? Can they push yet? This thing, which normally looks like this, this is the opening to the cervix, which is very small. In delivery of a baby, this is what has to expand to be about 10 centimeters in size. And that's what hurts during labor, is one of the main things that hurts during labor, is the stretching of all this tissue to get to be that size. So when we talk about the cervix, it's the opening to the uterus right here. This is where people take samples to get pap smears. If you hear about women going in to have a pap smear, what we're doing is we sample that area, we get some cells from that area, and put them on a slide, send them off to a lab, and they get read for whether or not there are normal cells there or precancerous cells. And we're testing with that test for cancer of the cervix. This is the vagina, and this is not what the opening to the vagina looks like, but this is a little bit easier way of drawing that. The difference between these two cervixes, in case you're wondering why I have these two funny drawings here, this is what one looks like before a woman has had children. This is what they usually look like after children. There's usually some scarring, and a little bit different shape and size to the opening of the cervix because it's had to go through that big stretching process and then come back. The other thing here besides the uterus is the lining of the uterus, which is the endometrium, and that's the part that develops a rich, heavy, bloody medium there basically for a fertilized egg to implant, and if a fertilized egg doesn't implant, that's what gets shed with a menstrual period. So that's the basic anatomy. Anybody have any questions about this stuff? I'm not losing anybody and everybody's falling asleep, okay. Then this is sort of what happens hormonally wise. And I'm not going to get into the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus is in the brain, and it makes a hormone called the gonadotropin-releasing factor, which you don't need to remember. But that influences another part of the brain called the anterior pituitary gland, which produces another set of hormones, which you don't have to remember, but this is the part that's most important, this little aspect right here. FSH and LH, what they do is they signal the ovaries to start maturing an egg. Now within the ovaries, when a woman is born or a baby girl is born, they have between 100,000 to 400,000, they're called oocytes or precursors of eggs, of mature eggs that could eventually become fertilized by sperm and then become a baby. So that is, every girl that's born starts out with that large number of eggs. By the time they reach puberty, they've already lost a large percentage of those eggs. The body just reabsorbs them. Then during the years that they have menstrual periods, every month they release one egg, and they usually also lose, and I can't remember the exact numbers, it's 100 or 1,000 eggs every month. It's not everyone develops into a full-blown, what we would call mature egg that could be fertilized. So what happens in the brain is that these two hormones, FSH and LH, stimulate the ovaries to start taking one of those small oocytes and make that start maturing. And as that matures and gets ready to be released, it puts out a couple of hormones. It first puts out estrogen, which you probably have all associated with that, you know, the female hormones. As it puts out estrogen, the egg itself, as it develops, puts out estrogen. What that estrogen does is it makes a lining in the uterus and makes that lining grow thicker and thicker and thicker. So estrogen's function, one of its many functions, is to make that lining grow thicker. It also turns off, and I didn't finish this drawing here, this goes back and affects up here. With high levels of estrogen, you start turning off this FSH-LH production. So this is it's a cyclical kind of arrangement. When this gets high, it turns this off. When this gets low, this gets turned back on. The other hormone that gets made then is it gets ready to be popped out of the ovary. And in the ovary, and I know this is not great drawings here, but it develops in a little sac. And then the egg kind of gets popped out of there. Well, this little sac, once the egg is released in what we call ovulation, and that's the time when a woman can get pregnant, is when they ovulate. The egg actually lives and it goes, travels from here down to the uterus. It's really only available for fertilization for about 24 hours, despite the fact that most people think you can get pregnant most all the time, and you should probably be worrying about it most all the time, but it really can only get fertilized for about a 24-hour period of time. And it takes a number of, do you remember how long it takes to get from the ovary into the uterus? I can't remember.
2.5 days.
Okay. So 2.5 days of moving down there, but during that time, there's only a short period where it's really viable to get fertilized. While that's happening, this little sac where the egg was developing is putting out another hormone called progesterone. What the progesterone does is holds this lining in place. So it's built up this nice, thick, heavy lining. Now the progesterone comes into play and holds the lining in play, and that's the hormone that's most active in the last 2 weeks of a cycle or the last week of a cycle. That's the hormone we most closely associate with PMS, for those of you who were sent here to find out about PMS.
You're sent here now.
No, a few people have told me they were sent here, so that's why I'm saying that, John. And then what happens if a fertilized egg is not, if an egg is not fertilized, it's lost, it goes out the vagina and into some vaginal discharge. And then eventually what will happen is the progesterone level will drop and the estrogen level will both drop when there's no pregnancy that occurs. When those two levels drop, that signals the FSH and LH to start pumping out again, to start signaling the ovary that it needs to start producing an egg, maturing an egg, so that you can produce these hormones again. So that's kind of the basic hormonal cycle. What happens in menopause basically is that when a woman was born with all those oocytes, by the time she reaches menopause, either all those oocytes are all gone, they've been all used up, or else the ones that are still there in the ovary no longer are responding to the FSH and LH. And so what happens in one chemical test we use sometimes to determine whether or not someone's menopausal is we test their blood levels of the FSH and LH. If these are very high, what it tells us is that the brain and these organs are trying very hard to stimulate the ovary to release an egg, but there isn't anything there to respond to that any longer. And so those FSH-LH levels will stay very high because there's no estrogen being produced. So that's the basic sort of chemical structure of what's going on there. Any questions with that? Go ahead.
Can we assume that any egg that gets released from the ovary is capable of becoming a fetus if it were fertilized? Like, is the ovary a good quality control of itself, or does it sometimes release a dud?
It sometimes releases a dud. I'm not exactly sure. I'm not very good at maybe answering that question. We get what we call blighted ovums, where people have an early pregnancy that's miscarried very early, and they talk about that being a blighted ovum. And I don't know if that's so much that the fertilization process didn't work real well, or if there was something really wrong with that egg. But that's a good question, and I can try and look it up in some of my magical books here, but I'm not exactly sure. I know that one of the things that have been speculated on, like with Down syndrome, and why do older women have more of a chance of having a Down syndrome child. One is that they feel that the eggs that have been sitting there, again, they've been sitting there since birth, and they're older eggs, they have more chance to go through some genetic mutations. But one of the other thoughts is that if an egg is fertilized closer to the end of that period of viability, that 24-hour period, that it already has gone through some changes, and it by that time has already had some problems. And so if you have fertilization later in the cycle, you're more likely to have some problems with that egg. Go ahead.
During the menstrual cycle, mm-hmm. when's the egg most likely to be fertilized?
The egg is most likely to be fertilized. I'm going to pass this little thing around. We'll show you a little bit. And this talks about those different hormones that I talked about, the LH and FSH, and you can see sort of when they surge, and then the estrogen, and when the progesterone comes on. This is the ovary that's sitting in its little sac and gets developed, and then this is the sac, and it produces the progesterone. You can see as it's there. And then this is sort of the menstrual lining right here. Right down the middle is what we call ovulation, at about day 14. This period right here, between the time that all this hormonal activity starts and an egg is released, is the most variable part of a cycle. Some women have every 28-day cycle. Some women have completely goofy cycles that you can't calendar, you can't figure it out on a calendar at all. And one of the reasons is that this part of the cycle, where the FSH and LH are stimulating the ovary to make estrogen, is the part of the cycle that can be most affected by stress, physical and emotional stress. And then after ovulation occurs, it's almost like clockwork in almost every woman that it'll be 12 to 14 days before her period comes. So unfortunately, there's not a good way to tell you beforehand when they're most likely to get pregnant or when that time of ovulation is. It's a lot easier to look back from the time someone's period starts, count back 12 to 14 days, and that's probably when they ovulated. There are some physical symptoms that are associated with ovulation. Some women get some low back pain about the time that the egg gets released. Some people feel kind of bloated. One of the most surefire things is a discharge, a vaginal discharge that's very, very clear. Now, some people use what's called natural family planning, and they do that by a couple of different means. And they look for, and I'm going to pass around a thing here about that. One, they check people's temperatures. And you take your temperature with a special thermometer, and I guess I don't have a picture of that. It's called a basal body thermometer. It measures very small increments of change in your temperature. And when a woman ovulates, there's usually a temperature rise at that time. This works only if you take your temperature every single day, first thing in the morning. We use it for people who either want to use this method to not get pregnant or for people who are trying to get pregnant so they can figure out the best time to have sex. This kind of shows you what happens with the temperature chart. And the other side shows you a little bit about the mucus. We see what's called fertile mucus at the time of ovulation. Fertile mucus is clear, real clear. It's almost like egg white. It's real stretchy and clear mucus that comes from the vagina, comes out of the vagina. It actually comes from higher up in the cervix. What it does is it actually makes like a chemical ladder for sperm to crawl right on up. And so that's why we call it fertile mucus, and that's one sign that someone's ovulating. About the time that you see that is about the time someone would be ovulating. During the rest of a cycle, typically, normal vaginal discharge is constantly going on because of the estrogen stimulation that is there. The vagina is really what I call a self-cleaning organism. It's constantly making discharge to clean itself. And the discharge you see in the first half of the cycle, when you're mostly getting that estrogen stimulation, some people don't have very much at all, and some women have kind of a clear or white discharge, and it tends to be stickier. And the second half of the cycle, it tends to be stickier. But the stuff right at the time of ovulation is real clear and real stretchy. And it may not be something that you're aware of, but most women are usually pretty aware of it, and you can certainly ask them, you know, when they know they're experiencing that kind of fertile mucus. Actually, some of the birth control methods that we use work to change the quality of that mucus. The progesterone-only birth control methods make that mucus more sticky and tacky and make it harder for sperm. It creates like a maze, so sperm can't get up there as easily. Does that answer your question? I know that was kind of a long, complicated answer, but go ahead.
I have a related one. Just where in the geography of this
does it fertilization occur?
Most
often, it's up here in the fallopian tube, and this is, and then it has to travel down. So, for example, it takes about a week. Boy, I'm too far away from work. I do this every day at work, but now I can't remember. It takes about a week from the time that you said it was 2.5 days, but I think it's longer than that. To get back down here. But from the time the egg is actually fertilized before it gets implanted. And so sometimes, especially I see a lot of women who come to me, they find out that they're pregnant and they go, oh my gosh, you know, we really were drinking really hard this day. They're quite concerned about fetal alcohol syndrome, early, you know, being exposed to alcohol early in a pregnancy. The fetus is not connected up to the woman's bloodstream really until it gets implanted here. So if that kind of drinking or use of drugs, that kind of thing occurs before implantation, there's not as much chance that there's going to be damage done there, but it's after implantation that we start worrying about it. Another little thing, as long as we're in the fallopian tube area, that I can talk about is sexually transmitted diseases and why they're so devastating for women. Women suffer usually much more serious consequences from sexually transmitted diseases than men, and one of the prime reasons for that is that a couple of the sexually transmitted diseases cause a lot of scarring in the fallopian tubes. The infectious process causes inflammation in the fallopian tubes and then scarring. And that scar, we can treat most sexually transmitted diseases that cause this kind of stuff with antibiotics, get rid of the actual organism, but we can't do anything to treat that scarring. That scar tissue is there for the rest of a woman's life. And our concern is with that is if you can imagine if this is kind of a thin tube through here, and if you get some scar tissue built up here, after ovulation, one, either the egg is going to have a problem getting all the way through this tube, and if it does get fertilized, if a sperm manages to make it up here, fertilize an egg, the egg can't get any further. A pregnancy can actually start developing here in the fallopian tube, and that's something called an ectopic pregnancy. It means an out-of-place pregnancy, a pregnancy that's happening not where it should be happening. What can happen is this tube isn't a very stretchy little organism here, and what will happen eventually is that egg will start growing just like it were a normal pregnancy, and it will cause this tube to burst, or can cause that tube to burst, and that can lead to either a severe infection or a severe amount of bleeding that can actually be fatal for a woman. So our concern is about ectopic pregnancies with sexually transmitted diseases. It's also, we're concerned about infertility. If these tubes are scarred enough, people are not going to be able to get pregnant. Just a sort of international note about that, when we think about sexually transmitted diseases, in third world countries especially, where a lot of women are unfortunately in situations where husbands or partners are off working someplace else and then come back to them, there is a lot more sexually transmitted disease than we see frequently in our country. And in those situations, what happens frequently is men who have been far away, say, if you think about South Africa, for example, and in the mines, and the men are working far away, they come back home, they bring with them a sexually transmitted disease from a partner that they had elsewhere, they give that to their wife, she ends up getting scar tissue, that scar tissue causes her to be infertile and not be able to have children, and in most third world cultures, that is the end of that relationship. Those women then frequently are in a divorced or abandoned situation and may turn to prostitution, which then leads to HIV infections. So, I mean, we have a lot of problems with sexually transmitted diseases and the repercussions for women, but in third world countries, it's especially serious, and there is a big connection between what we consider to be the more minor sexually transmitted diseases and the development of HIV or AIDS. Yeah?
This is, I guess, a little different from something you said earlier, mm-hmm. about related to miscarriage, I think, about mutation. Is the can you say a little bit more about that and how exactly that happens if you, if that's where your knowledge extends?
Let me think. Well, miscarriages can happen for a lot of different reasons, and we don't always know why. There can be problems with the hormonal balance. What happens after an egg is fertilized is that that little unit starts producing another hormone called beta-HCG, which is what we measure with pregnancy tests. And the reason why we are now able to determine very early that someone is pregnant is because we have such sensitive tests that can read a rise in a very small rise in that hormone in a woman's bloodstream, so that 10 days after pregnancy, we are now able to do a pregnancy test and have a good result and know whether or not someone's pregnant. In the past, the tests that we had available didn't give us that answer for, okay, blank in my knowledge, weeks. I don't know how long it was. Was it 3 weeks? Because as the pregnancy develops, that hormone increases. The pregnancy itself or the fetus puts out more and more and more of that chemical. For various hormonal reasons, sometimes there isn't enough, for example, progesterone. And the progesterone is affected by the beta-HCG. It encourages this little sac here to keep putting out progesterone to keep holding that lining in place until a placenta can develop around that egg and support the pregnancy. And sometimes if the hormonal orchestration is not right for any number of reasons, a miscarriage can occur. Sometimes there can be some kind of genetic abnormality or physical abnormality with that pregnancy and the way that fertilization occurred that can cause a miscarriage. I guess I don't really consider myself an expert in that. Those are kind of general causes. Go ahead.
I mean, I can throw out a couple things. One was that when Jeff suggested, asked whether there were duds or not, I thought that was kind of a neat way of putting it. I think there are probably two potential types of dud eggs that you could have. One would be an egg that's not readily fertilized for some reason that has, a bad outer shell. And I don't think that happens very often. But as Carol said, as women get older, the likelihood of having a ovum that carries mutations increases. And mutations can be in any part of the gene, any part of the human chromosomes. So the mutations could be for any aspect of the body, any part of the body's chemistry, any part of the, anatomy, arms, legs, et cetera, internal organs. Some of those mutations are going to be aspects of the, the little fetus that have to do with its ability to actually attach and stimulate development of a placenta. And so there are a certain percentage, I think it's about a third, but maybe you know that number better, Carol, of ova that are sufficiently mutated in their ability to form a placenta and therefore get aborted spontaneously.
Mm-hmm. Which happens very early, frequently before someone even recognizes that they've missed a period.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of real early miscarriages.
You said over here that this little sac here that once it
spits out an egg
that starts creating progesterone.
Right.
And that has something to do with PMS.
We think it has something to do with PMS. We know that's
Is that in the fall, in the tapering off?
It's partly some of the effects on the body of progesterone itself.
Which are
bloating, weight gain, water retention, sometimes some breast tenderness. Some of these are associated with both hormones and can occur almost anywhere in the cycle. And, we do have a combination of higher levels of progesterone along with relatively high levels of estrogen at this point in the cycle. So it can come from either one of those, but frequently people associate the changes of PMS with progesterone. But some of the mood changes, for example, that we see in PMS, some people do relate to progesterone. And the reason I'm putting it in terms of some people is because there is quite a bit of research that has gone on about PMS and quite a bit of research that needs to be done about PMS, and we don't have a lot of what I would consider to be real firm answers about it, what causes it, why some people have it, why other people don't. One of the things the research seems to indicate is that women who have PMS probably won't have it for their entire lifetime. They tend to have it for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 year cycles, maybe at a time, maybe never get it again after leaving that cycle, but maybe will get it again. It also seems that women tend to have more PMS actually as they get older. It tends to be a more serious problem for women approaching menopause, and actually some women in what we call the perimenopausal period, right before they actually get into real menopause, you know, where the periods cease altogether, but when they're going through some hormonal fluctuation, have a pretty severe problem with PMS. And actually it's interesting because some people have suggested using progesterone to treat PMS, and which seems sort of like fighting fire with fire, but for some people it works really well. And for other people, it's a complete disaster. So in terms of treatment for PMS, we have a number of different treatments. We haven't been able to find one that seems to suit everybody, and that may be because everybody's PMS may be caused by slightly different reasons, both a combination of hormones and emotional stressors and maybe physical stressors. But I wish for your sake and for the sake of many of my patients that I had more concrete answers about PMS, but there aren't a lot of concrete answers. There are lots of things we can try. And I don't discourage people from coming in to talk with myself or a physician about PMS because there are a lot of different treatment regimes that we can try with different people. We just don't have one sort of magic bullet cure for it. But it's not something that's all in women's heads. I was instructed to say this by many women when they heard I was doing this session. It's not all in our heads. There are certainly physical components to it. So.
And weapons are not one of the treatment programs, right?
Not in most cases, no. Exercise actually is an excellent treatment, and that's one thing that studies have shown, that it won't completely cure PMS, but for most people have significantly decreased symptoms with an exercise program. And also, I advocate a lot of diet changes, exercise, and trying in any way possible to learn some relaxation techniques to try and reduce the amount of stress, because emotional stress is certainly a part of that. And I also have some vitamin supplements that I use with some people, sometimes with good success. Some people I put on birth control pills, people who haven't been on birth control pills, and sometimes that helps regulate a cycle well enough so that they don't have PMS. For other people, it makes their PMS absolutely go crazy. So, what I tend to think of with all the drugs that I use is that we have statistical information about how drugs work in people, but until we actually give an individual a particular drug, we don't know what's going to happen. It's sort of like a medical experiment every time we give somebody a drug. And that goes with birth control pills. If you've had friends or sisters or partners who have been on birth control pills and have had problems with one pill and not another, I mean, that's part of what's going on there, is that different people respond differently to birth control pills and to different birth control pills. I've got a lot of gadgets that I can pass around here too, and maybe I'll just do that and talk about them a little bit, keep asking these questions. This is a speculum, and most of the women that I talked to hadn't ever had a chance to really touch one or see how they work, and I thought probably you have even less chance of ever touching one or seeing how they work. So I thought I'd show you what frequently when women come to see me for their annual exam, they say, I wish so much he had to come in for this so we could see what this was like. So anyway, here's what happens. This is the instrument that we use to be able to visualize the cervix, to be able to look down the vagina and see the cervix. I have some pictures actually of some archaic speculums that were found in Pompeii. Just for a little medical interest here, and some other dreadful things that were used on women in the darker ages.
And these aren't dreadful?
These are pretty dreadful. Mm. These are relatively dreadful, though I also try and do a public relations job with most of my patients about how not dreadful they are. Mm. They aren't, for example, this is one that we use on women who have had children. You can see it's a little bit fatter than this one that's a little bit thinner that we tend to use on women who haven't had children. The only part of this whole ugly thing that actually goes into a woman's vagina is from here on up. And so what I tell most people is that this probably isn't a whole lot bigger than most erect penises. So, you know, I mean, we're not talking about something gigantic here. And if they do get pregnant, a baby's going to come through there. So, I mean, and which isn't comfortable either, but anyway. What happens with the speculum is that this is placed into the vagina. And then what I do with it, and the reason we use it, is I push this part to open it up so that I can see down the vagina to the cervix. And then I use a little finger screw here to keep it open. Because the vagina is not really an open space. It's a potential space. It's got fleshy tissue that's going to just compact on itself unless there's something in there to keep it open. And that's why we have to use a speculum. And then I use various instruments to get... I, through the vagina to the cervix to actually get the samples I need. For example, samples of discharge that I would need to test someone for sexually transmitted disease like chlamydia or gonorrhea. Then when we do the pap smear, we actually take a scraping of some of the cells here from the cervix. So I'll pass one of these around, and you can think how glad you are that you don't have to have these.
You know, one of the things, when I do sexually transmitted disease exams on men, they frequently complain about the little swabs that they have to stick in the anus of the penis to get the samples for sexually transmitted diseases. And I always tell them, this ain't nothing, buddy. because
well, no, I have to say that on the part of men, you know, I mean, the woman's urethra is a different place. Her urine comes from someplace else. It doesn't come through the vagina. Both your urethra and the sexually transmitted disease canal, whatever, I don't know what, okay, here's how dumb I am about male anatomy. What's that called? It's the urethra, isn't that how it's called? Right, yeah, exactly. So it has a little bit more nerve endings, and I think it's more painful.
That's true, I agree. But I agree that for that split second it may be a little more uncomfortable, but the whole process is nothing compared to your speculum exam, I think.
Right, duck bills. Yeah, that's what we call them here. So.
Do you heat these?
Yes, I do.
I've always been curious about that.
Yeah, and I encourage people, women to be assertive and tell their practitioners to heat them. They're also plastic ones, which I discourage people from using for a couple of reasons. One, they'll be in the landfill forever. You know, we don't need a lot of speculums in our landfills. They're only used once, they're thrown away. I find that they're more difficult to maneuver, and I end up pinching people more often with them. These, you have better control with. I warm them under warm water, or else I have them sitting on a heating pad that's going all the time. So they can be warmed, and what happens with them is they get sterilized and used over and over and over and over and over again. So let's see, anything else here I can show you for fun?
You usually get told that most male doctors would not warm them? Or?
No, I would say that in the past that was maybe true, but I do think that that either, you know, women have done a good job of educating their physicians, or physician education is training has changed enough so that men are becoming more sensitive. Why are you smirking with stuff?
I just, that's my answer.
If any of you have, well, here's a little topic we can talk about. Some sexually transmitted diseases. We talked already about the kind that can cause some scarring in the fallopian tubes. Another sexually transmitted disease that women suffer from more than men is genital warts. And genital warts are caused by a virus, and the viral sexually transmitted diseases are a lot worse and nastier things to deal with than the bacterial ones. The bacterial ones are things like syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. The viral ones are herpes and genital warts, also called human papillomavirus, HPV, or condyloma. You may have heard any of those names for genital warts. And they're all caused by viruses, and of course the other big bad virus, bad virus is the HIV virus. So, and for all of these viruses, once they're in somebody's system, they're there for the rest of your life. At this point, there's no getting rid of them. And we can treat some of the manifestations of these viruses, but not even all of them. And one of the reasons we do our cervical cancer tests or screening on women with the pap smear is that we have now pretty much determined that cervical cancer is caused or closely associated with the virus that causes warts, genital warts, the human papillomavirus. So that in most cases, we now believe that cervical cancer is related to a sexually transmitted disease. The more partners a woman has had, the more likely she is to have cervical cancer. Now with warts, and I always tell this, and just, you know, I always say this to my patients, and now it'd be nice to get a little nice feedback from men about this, is I tell women that there are two kinds of guys, okay, three kinds of guys, I've changed it now. Three kinds of guys out there. There are the jerks that know they have something and don't care and pass it on to people. There are the men that maybe if they thought about it hard enough would realize they had something, but it's not bothering them, so they really don't think about it and they pass it on. And then I think the vast majority of people have absolutely no idea that they're carrying a sexually transmitted disease, that they got it without their knowledge. They are maybe not having very many symptoms, and they pass it on to a partner. And that can be true for both the warts and the herpes. And certainly for HIV. With warts, what we see is on the shaft or the head of the penis. You can get little cauliflowery looking. They can be tiny. They can be so tiny you can't even see them. But they can grow to be relatively large in size. What happens then if a guy has those on his penis and has intercourse, they can get that virus then can get introduced either on the outside in the labia of a woman or around the opening to the vagina, or actually that virus can affect the cervix. And if it does affect the cervix, it can cause some changes that can lead to cervical cancer. And that's why we do the pap smear, and it's why I'm so bad with numbers. What's the percentage decrease of cervical cancer since we started doing pap smears? We started doing pap smears in the 1940s, and there's been a 70% decrease in cervical cancer since that time. So it's been a very effective screening mechanism. And you may have heard from friends, wives, partners, that they had an abnormal pap smear, and there's a whole range of different pap smear abnormalities we can see. The one that's still in most common usage is the class system, and class 1 is a completely normal pap smear. Class 2 pap smears usually indicate there might be some kind of mild inflammation process going on at the cervix, and we want to check that again to make sure it's not something worse. But a class 3 pap smear and beyond are things that we need to investigate more and may need to actually take some tissue samples from the cervix and require more medical intervention. And this is just some ideas of what we see when we look at a pap smear, if anybody's interested in.
Why are they called pap smear?
Developed by a doctor named Dr. Pepa Nicholas in the 1940s. So, and that was actually a pretty revolutionary development, because I think up until that time, a lot of gynecological care was done for illness. And I think with the development of that test and some other tests since that time, we do a lot more preventative care with gynecology, which is why we send people in for their yearly exams, is to look for problems like that, problems with the ovaries. Ovarian cancer is something that's very, very rare, but very deadly. And we can sometimes pick up some changes on our exam that may indicate early ovarian cancer. Any other questions? Yes.
Talking about the cycle,
mm-hmm.
Are there ways of changing the length of that other than, say birth control pills or?
Other than hormonal interventions, women can change that in relation to stress. Again, because stress can affect the production of these hormones up here that will change how a cycle works. And if women get below a certain weight, for example, if they're, we see this a lot in teenagers who are just starting to have their period, may have very regular periods because they haven't quite reached the body mass that allows them to have regular periods. We think it's very closely associated with body mass. And also we see that, for example, in people who are marathon runners, who are anorexic or have bulimia, and for a lot of different physical stress reasons stop having periods altogether. But also stress can cause that first part of the cycle to vary, which will change their period. But other than giving people hormones, there's not a way that I know of to control the bleeding.
Because after having had chemotherapy,
mm-hmm.
Barb went from 28 days
right.
to like 21 or 22
right.
days.
And we talked about that, and I'm not exactly sure what happened with that, other than I can only imagine that chemotherapy was quite a major, you know, physical stress.
Yeah.
And I'm not exactly sure at what point, you know, in there's a sort of a long concert of things that have to happen. Mm. Together to make a cycle happen, and I don't know what would have changed necessarily with the chemotherapy that would have caused that kind of change.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it's trivial, but it's trivial.
There are no
in a sense.
Trivial questions here.
I one time traveled with a large group of women, and I was
mm-hmm.
one of few men in
mm-hmm.
the group, and the women
all got their periods at the same time.
Yeah, they synchronized. Could you explain the mechanics of that?
I'd like to be able to. I don't think anybody can at this point. Some people have speculated that it may be because of, I'm not going to say this right, how do you say it?
Pheromones
mm-hmm. Which are released and that may cause women to synchronize to each other. But I'm not sure that anybody really knows that.
It's a very curious
thing.
Yeah,
it is. It's a curious phenomenon. It happens a lot.
Did that happen in tribal communities? You know, you hear about the women were isolated.
It could well be, and maybe that was maybe a... of course, that would kind of throw the community pretty off if they were all in the unclean hut at the same time. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not
Here's
sure.
Here's a community question again, but mm-hmm. in this community in the winter, mm-hmm. is the potential of this happening seems to be fairly great, I would imagine.
Well, I haven't taken a survey. You could ask the women of the
winter
community.
Well, I mean, not a survey, but I just speculate.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah. Well, what exactly is a yeast infection, and what does yogurt have to do with it?
Okay, good question. Yeast infection is, I'll do a Bill Clinton here now. I like Bill Clinton, but this is what he does when he answers this question. He goes, that's a good question. And then you can tell he's like processing it, or trying to look like he's processing it, but I do like him. What happens with a yeast infection is, one of the things that happens in the response to these hormones is that the pH balance or the, this isn't the only thing that is part of this, but this is part of it. The pH balance or the acid-base balance changes in the vagina. And women and men have yeast growing in their gastrointestinal system, in your gut, in your intestine. It's there for most people, or a large percentage of people, all the time, to varying and lesser degrees. And the opening of the gastrointestinal system, the rectum, is very close to the vagina. We think that that's probably how it ends up in the vagina. For a lot of people, it's just part of the normal constellation of different organisms in the vagina all the time. But under certain circumstances, that yeast production is increased. And some of those circumstances can be different points in the menstrual cycle as the pH balance changes in the vagina. It can have to do, for example, women who have diabetes and have a higher blood sugar level can have more problems with yeast infection because that higher blood sugar level can feed that. People on birth control pills, again, because that changes a little bit the way their hormones work, are at more risk for an overgrowth of yeast in that area.
Antibiotics.
And antibiotics, thank you. And antibiotics, because what antibiotics do is they kill off all the other bacteria in the vagina that are sort of keeping everything in balance. And once those other things are killed off, it's sort of like a vacancy sign saying, you know, opening here for organism to please grow in large amounts and cause problems. And so yeast that yeast will do that. And the symptoms of a yeast infection are a white, curdy discharge, almost like cottage cheese, though sometimes you don't necessarily see that, and itching from hell. You know, and it's not fun. And there are a lot of different things that have been tried to treat that. Yogurt is one of the things. There was a study that came out this year that showed that women who ate 8 ounces of yogurt with an active acidophilus culture in it, if they ate that every single day, they decreased their prevalence of yeast infections. One of the reasons that that probably helps is it may decrease the amount of yeast in the gut, so there may not be as much there to get up into the vagina. Other people have suggested the use of yeast, yogurt in the vagina itself, and that's again to reintroduce one of the good bacteria in the vagina, or the lactobacillus, which is similar to the lactobacillus that's in yogurt. One of the problems with that is the kind of lactobacillus that you need in your vagina to keep everything healthy produce hydrogen peroxide, and it's very difficult, and we haven't really found anything that replicates the body's ability to produce lactobacillus that produce hydrogen peroxide. But lots of women swear by yogurt, and either putting yogurt directly into the vagina or taking tablets that contain acidophilus and release some of those bacteria. But basically it's sort of trying to reestablish a healthy environment in the vagina. And a yeast infection means that something is out of balance there. And that's not necessarily a sexually transmitted disease. Some people consider it instead of an STD, an SAD, a sexually associated disease. Semen can cause a change in the pH balance in the vagina, and occasionally, especially in uncircumcised males, they can harbor some yeast organisms underneath the foreskin, and so they can pass some on, you know, and reintroduce more yeast organisms in the vagina.
Being in the kitchen, obviously around the food, they produce some gas and things. Mm-hmm. Is that similar inside the body?
Boy, you know, I don't know about that, but I've been experiencing these yeast, experiencing gas inside the body. Mm-hmm. The more bread you eat here, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know.
Gas inside the body. I think it's a different type
of yeast, right,
that we use in bread cultures than generally colonizes and causes problems in the vagina.
Oh, I wasn't suggesting that. What I was suggesting is the response of a yeast or a wee beastie, whatever these little characters do.
They're funguses, yeah.
They produce excrement or
gas
of sorts. And mm-hmm. I was just wondering if that was a problem.
Not per se in vaginal infections that I know of. What they do is produce a lot of irritation in the cells that line the vagina.
I think there's two things. One is that women frequently, when they get yeast infections, douche or think mm-hmm. they ought to be douchey. Mm-hmm. Or women frequently think or sometimes have pressure to douche after intercourse or before intercourse, etc. And I think what we've discovered in recent years is that douching actually disrupts the natural microbial barrier of the vagina and predisposes to yeast infections. And so that's one thing to think about. The other is just to mention that there are a number of yogurts that don't have active cultures, and even some of the ones that do have active active acidophilus or other lactobacilli in there aren't necessarily the kind of acidophilus that can do useful things in the vagina. So one of the things we don't know yet, even though the study that Carol alluded to that was published, you know, half a year or so ago, that shows that some types of yogurt can be helpful for treating yeast infections. It's not necessarily the case that all types of yogurt can be helpful for yeast infections. And personally, my belief, and I think many other people's belief too, is that some of the tablets that you get in the nutrition stores or, you know, in the drugstore that supposedly contain acidophilus cultures may not necessarily be helpful either. So at this point, the best we can tell is yogurt is sort of a hit or miss therapy for yeast infections. And probably the best thing to do about yeast infections is to try and do some good preventive health care for them, like trying not to douche and trying to keep the antibiotics one takes down the Del Roar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. menopause. Mm-hmm. What is it? What are symptoms? Okay. What happens?
I talked a little bit about this cycle and the fact that, you know, when the eggs are gone or when there's only a few there left, that people start experiencing some symptoms. Officially right now, the definition of menopause is when periods stop. It's difficult with menopause because when I was doing my research on this, I found that there's no one set of definitions that everybody agrees with in terms of menopause. There have been no studies done on the natural course of menopause. What medicine has done basically is focus on what I would call the estrogen deprivation state of menopause. In other words, because you're not producing an egg every month, you're not spitting out all this estrogen every month. And so a lot of the effects that we see in menopause are because women don't have that kind of estrogen any longer. And that's why we treat them with hormone replacement therapy, where we give them estrogen and we give them progesterone every month. So it's been studied largely in what I would call the disease model as an estrogen deprivation disease, and we treat it by giving people estrogen, and the symptoms that we see are because they don't have those levels of estrogen ever any longer in their bodies. Some of the symptoms are very irregular periods. Let me go back just another step. Before the menopause is this period called the perimenopause, which can last anywhere from 1 year to 10 years as women go through some hormonal changes. And that can be related to how this first part of the cycle works and how the eggs are responding to that, and there are a lot of different factors involved in that. But that periods can start becoming very irregular. One of the reasons can be that, as I said before, that the eggs that are in here don't always respond to that FSH and LH stimulation as much. It may take longer for an egg to respond to the FSH and LH than it did before. So that can cause some irregularity in the menstrual periods. Sometimes an egg doesn't respond at all, and the body builds that lining in the uterus, but it doesn't really have the progesterone coming from this egg sac to hold that lining in place. So it can keep building and building and building a lining, but the egg doesn't get ovulated, and so there's no progesterone, and so what can happen is people can develop this very thick lining, nothing to hold it in place, and start having some either spotting or some very, very heavy, long, 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 long periods. So there are a wide range of variations in what happens in women's periods with menopause. One of the most sort of classical symptoms of menopause with that is that people's periods get shorter and closer together. But for some people, they get longer and closer together, and some get longer and further apart. And for a lot of that bleeding, it's probably normal and due to some of the hormonal changes. We always want to be sure that it's not being caused by an abnormal development, for example, cancer of the uterus. That's the thing we worry about with abnormal bleeding. And so it is a good idea when women start having these real regular periods to go in and get checked out and be sure that there isn't a problem going on. One of the ways that we can treat this early on is if people have this heavy bleeding that won't stop, if they've got like a week-long period or two-week-long period or three-week-long period, we give them just progesterone. And what that does, we give it to them for 10 days at a time, that holds that lining in place for 10 days, and at the end of that time, they lose that lining. And for some people, that means they can sort of have a clean start again, rather than just kind of continuing to sort of bleed off that heavy lining that's there. You just get rid of it altogether. That's one of the sort of, in the meantime, kind of treatments until menopause actually occurs. Some of the other symptoms that women notice with menopause is hot flashes. We aren't exactly sure why those happen, other than we know that temperature regulation in the body is controlled, is closely associated with a lot of those organs where we're also producing a lot of these precursor hormones. And so it could be that just because of some of that hormone irregularity, we're also getting all these temperature irregularities. But it was interesting because I'm not perimenopausal at this point. I'm not having hot flashes. But when I spoke to a group of women who all basically were, it was great. I said, well, I have here the textbook definition of the hot flash. Would anyone like to share with me? And I had, you know, about 15 people here who were all very, very able to describe to me what hot flash is like. And those can be real debilitating for women and real embarrassing, because usually what comes along with that is flushing, and they get very red and they may perspire heavily. It makes it difficult to concentrate if you feel like all of a sudden someone lit a fire underneath you and you're just burning up for a 2 or 3 minute period of time, but it can seem like a lot longer than that. Some women have those for 1 year, some women have those for 5 years. We don't exactly know why some people have more problems with it than others. One of the other things associated with that is sleep deprivation. Women get these at night and wake up just drenched in sweat, and it wakes them up. And we think that maybe some of the emotional problems that people associate with menopause or think of when they think of menopause and they think of women with these raging hormones who are completely emotionally out of control may have a lot to do with actually with sleep deprivation, that they're not being able to get a good night's sleep because they wake up frequently with this drenching business. So those are some of the things we see. Another thing that we see is eventually some vaginal dryness. The vagina and the tissue that line the vagina are very affected by estrogen, and estrogen keeps that tissue stretchy and moist and influences its ability to lubricate itself. And as women get older and have less estrogen in their system, they tend to get vaginas that are drier, less flexible. They may develop pain with intercourse. And so again, that's one of the reasons why we treat menopause with estrogen, because giving people estrogen pills will cause a lot of that lubrication and that flexibility in the vagina to return. And I'm trying to think, there's a whole lot, I could talk for about an hour about menopause, but I don't know that I
Another approach to that, at least to the vaginal dryness, is you still give creams?
Yeah, we use estrogen cream, and some people don't like to take the estrogen pills. We do give estrogen cream. One of the problems with that is it's difficult to determine how much of the estrogen is being picked up by the bloodstream, because this area has a lot of blood circulation in it, so it's going to pick up that estrogen. It's not like going to just affect the vagina. It can cause some systemic effects as well, and so we're a little bit more hesitant to give that. We also use lubricants. I did bring some lubricants here, and that can lead to a discussion. Lubricants are helpful for women both in menopause, as there's more vaginal dryness. They also can be helpful after pregnancy. When women are breastfeeding, they tend to also not have that same estrogen production and tend to have pretty dry vaginas, and it can be very uncomfortable to have sex. And if women aren't sexually aroused sufficiently before intercourse, they're also going to have problems with lubrication. And some women just have a chronic problem with that. And there are a number of lubricants available on the market for use with sex. I only recommend water-soluble lubricants, things that are going to break down with the natural, you know, water in the body. KY jelly is a good one that you can always buy at drugstores, but it gets kind of goopy. And these are some new products that have come out that are much more... they imitate sort of natural lubrication a little bit more. So if anybody wants to try these out, they can do that as well. Here, so I'll pass that one. So people don't have to always suffer with bad gastroenteritis.
Where can you get these things, Jeff?
Where can you get these things? Most of these are available at drugstores. Yeah, truck stops and drugstores. in the Seattle area, lubricants and condoms, a wonderful supply of condoms are available at a great place called the Rubber Tree. And for people here at Holden, you can get things from them by mail order. And I'll pass around a little blurb here on dental dams, which is another thing. This is something that's being suggested for sexually transmitted disease prevention in oral sex if it's not mouth-to-penis contact, because if mouth-to-penis contact, we suggest the use of a condom, but if there's any other kind of mouth-to-genital contact, we're suggesting the use of dental dams. This is to prevent the transmission of HIV, though there have not been any known cases of people contracting HIV just from oral sex. The other thing that I feel like they're maybe more valuable from is because you can transmit oral herpes to the genital area or genital herpes to the oral area. And so dental dams are important for transmission of herpes. One of the scary things about herpes is that it can be an asymptomatic disease and frequently is, that people have absolutely no symptoms of herpes and can still pass them on or don't have symptoms that they recognize as being herpes and can pass those on. So I'm going to pass this around. This is a blurb about dental dams, but at the bottom is the address for this place in Seattle called the Rubber Tree. They are run by Zero Population Growth, and they provide wonderful supply of condoms, again by mail order, also lubricants and dental dams, as well as a lot of good safe sex information. So people can take a look at those. And this is their brochure about condoms, how to use them, and there's an article in the back about correct use of condoms. I've got lots of different condoms. This is one of the things that I probably don't have to do with this mature audience, but with high school boys who like to say they can't possibly wear a condom because they're too big to fit a condom. This is one of the tricks I learned from them. Is that, oops, well that one, don't use this brand, very bad. Trojans, very bad, very bad, very bad. Okay, let me see if I can try another one. Winston, quit laughing at me.
Nothing good
with
you.
Yeah. Nothing new. You can. So it's probably not going to be too tight.
Awesome.
Anyway, these are questions maybe Winston can better address than I can. But anyway, one of the brands of condoms that I strongly recommend to my patients is the Mentor brand of condom. The reason for this is, especially if you're not using spermicide, which you should be using with condoms, for a couple of different reasons. Spermicides help prevent sexually transmitted diseases. They do help. They won't kill off all sexually transmitted disease organisms, but they'll probably cut down the number that are there. The Mentor brand of condom has a couple of added features that, in my opinion, make it better. One is it has what's called an application sleeve, so you're less likely to rip the condom when you're opening up the package, which is one place the condoms fail right away, is that people rip them when they're opening up the package.
It also makes it a lot harder to put it on backwards.
And it makes it a lot harder to put it on backwards, which is one of the big problems with condoms. If you put on a condom and you put it on first like this and then realize, oh, it's inside out, don't turn it over and then put it on. The fluid that's right at the end of the penis before you have an ejaculation contains, certainly if you were HIV infected, contains the highest concentration of HIV virus, but it also contains sperm, and so can potentially cause pregnancy and can certainly potentially cause a sexually transmitted disease. So that is the wrong way to put on a condom. If you make that mistake, you gotta get rid of that condom and start all over again, because it's already been, basically, you can consider it used. And this one, you can't really put it on backwards because this is what it looks like, and you aren't going to be trying probably to put it on that way.
No,
And the other advantage of it is that at the bottom of this condom there is a little ring of adhesive, and so it's going to stay in place after you lose your erection, which is the other time when people tend to have the most leakage from condoms, because once you lose your erection and the penis gets small in here, that's when you can leak out the kind of stuff that you don't want to leak out. So
you can wear these mentioned things all night if you
want. So, anyway, so I'll pass these around and you can see this brand here. if anybody has never used a condom, wants to try one out here.
The outside is the one that has the sleeve on it. In the regular condoms, the outside, I don't know how to explain this without having a condom to show you, but basically
you want one here?
You can unroll. If you can unroll it, it's on right, okay?
If you can unroll,
It down the shaft of your penis, you've got it on right.
If you can't, it's not going to work. Here's a...
When you put it on first, the rolled up part should be
Someone's
on the outside,
stealing,
not inside.
Stealing condoms from our chalet. You realize that? They're not as many here as I brought.
That's good.
So, here's the thing about how to put condoms on and some... A highly scientific article from USA Today about how correct use of condoms is rare. I do hand this out to a lot of my patients. Also, little statistics here on what cities where condom distribution is being done in high schools and some of the effectiveness rates of condoms. Condoms used alone without spermicide are actually pretty good birth control, have a pretty high success rate. They have a higher success rate if used with spermicide, in fact, approach almost 100%. They're about as good, really, as birth control pills if you use a condom together with a spermicide.
Religiously,
thank you.
How come all the research for birth control is for female only?
Oh, well, that's a good question. And there is actually research on birth control for men, but largely being conducted right now by the World Health Organization and agencies that they fund. But interestingly enough, for the World Health Organization, one of their criteria for developing a male birth control method is that it have no side effects, which has sort of never been a criteria for female versions of birth control, interestingly enough. Consequently, not very many things are meeting that criteria.